Carl E. Eckman.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Gilstrap. I represent the petitioner. And as so often happens, here we have a very hard-fought and long piece of litigation that has boiled itself down to a single important issue. And that issue is this. Which side, the plaintiff or the defendant, bears the burden of proof with regard to the provisions of the Texas Business and Commerce Code, the DTPA, Section 17.454, which excludes from the benefits of the DTPA business consumers with assets in excess of $25 million. $25 million or more in assets are the operative words. Here, the Dallas Court of Appeals said there was no evidence that the petitioner had less than $25 million in assets and poured the petitioner out. Petitioner lost. He got a large verdict. The trial court said petitioner takes nothing, judgment NOV. The Dallas Court of Appeals upheld that. The Dallas Court of Appeals analysis of the evidence was wrong. As it turns out, and I think it's pretty clear now, there was evidence from which a jury could have gone either way had a jury been asked. The jury wasn't asked. And that is a complex procedural issue, at least I find it complex, but we don't need to get to that first. The first issue is burden of proof, and that's fairly simple. Both sides have joined issues on that, and both sides have agreed and fought it out on the basis of construing the statute and legislative intent, and that is how this court has historically dealt with DTPA issues. We look at the statute, we read the statute, and we try to divine legislative intent. There are several approaches to doing this, but I think the simplest one is one that the court used last week in a DTPA case, although the court was not construing the DTPA, and that was the Ojeda de Toca case, which the court handed down last week. And basically, in construing a statute, and especially the DTPA, because I believe it's written into the DTPA, there are cases that say this, that have construed the DTPA, you look at the old law, the evil, and the remedy. So therefore, I think it's important for us briefly to look at the state of the law back in 1983 when this provision was enacted and find out exactly what the legislature was trying to deal with. That should give us some indication as how we construe the statute today. Now, if you'll recall, when the DTPA was passed, I think it's pretty clear now, you may disagree, but I think it's pretty clear that from the beginning, the DTPA did include certain business and commercial transactions. The initial DTPA excluded from the definition of services, services for commercial or business use. Well, I think the inference from that is that goods purchased for commercial or business use were included within the DTPA. And there really wasn't much controversy over that. The controversy at that point was whether one who purchased for resale had really purchased for use. The court decided that issue in favor of a broad construction of the DTPA. And so when that happened and when the 77 legislature deleted the other than commercial or business use exception from the definition of services, at that point all commercial transactions were apparently within the DTPA. The legislature was troubled by that apparently. Their concern and the concern that motivated it to pass the particular statutory provision that's in front of us today was a concern that certain very large business transactions would be dealt with the same way that a consumer who had been tricked into buying aluminum siding for his house. The same statute would apply. The legislature sought a way to exclude certain of these transactions. There were two ways to do it. The first way was type of transaction. The second way was the wealth or assets of the consumer. The legislature chose kind of a hybrid. It excluded business goods acquired for commercial or business use and plaintiffs or consumers that had assets of over $25 million. It also had earlier, and I need to digress and tell you this, earlier it had passed another provision to exclude certain persons from the DTPA. It was an amendment to 17.42, which allowed a consumer to waive the benefits of the act if he met certain criteria and if he had assets of $5 million or more. In the 1983 version of the act, that was where the court used the term business consumer. It used the term business consumer only in connection with those two statutes. I think it's pretty clear that the purpose of those two statutes was to exclude certain purposes from persons from the act, certain transactions. There is no indication that those statutes were passed to affect the rights of persons who remain within the DTPA. No indication that that was the evil that the legislature was trying to address. Yet, according to the Dallas Court of Appeals, the legislature, when it passed that particular statute, also placed a new requirement on consumers. A consumer had to negate this particular statutory provision. Now, in this case, we're only dealing with a $25 million or more exception because we pled that we were a business consumer. And so in this case, the court said we had to prove that we did not have assets of $25 million or more. The problem with that is it creates a terrible procedural trap. And you really have to, at least I have to think a while before you really realize how bad the trap is. Let me give you a couple of quick hypotheticals. Let's suppose I'm a brick mason. Let's suppose that times are hard and I go out and a builder says he wants me to put some brick on his house. And I go to my brick supplier, I owe him money, and I say, look, I don't have any money now. I've got $600, and that'll be enough for the brick. I know I owe you money, but let me give you the $600. You deliver the brick, and then when I get the money off this job, I'll come back and pay you. Brick supplier says, fine, I gave him the $600. The next day I'm at the job site, the truck shows up. No brick. Not for me. I go back to the brick supplier. He says, I'm sorry, I changed my mind. I decided to keep your money. I sue him under the DTPA. He misrepresented that I would have the brick. There's also a gross disparity issue. He took my money. I didn't get anything. I'm in the justice court. It's all over, and I stand up, and I present my case. And when it's over, the brick supplier's attorney stands up and says, Your Honor, defendant wins. This man was a business consumer, and he didn't prove that he had assets that he didn't have assets of $25 million or more. Under the respondent's approach to the case, that's the result. I submit that that is not the type of result the legislature intended when it passed the amendment to the statute we're dealing with. But it gets worse. Let's suppose I go out and I buy the house, and I sue the brick supplier because the brick turns out is crumbling. It's adobe brick. I present my case, and when it's over, the lawyer gets up and says, Your Honor, he didn't prove that he had assets of under $25 million. We said, wait a minute, he's not a business consumer. No, Your Honor, there was no evidence on that. He didn't prove whether the house was for rental or for occupancy. If it's for rental, it's for commercial use, and you've got to exclude it according to the Dallas Court of Appeals and according to the respondent. I submit that those type of results are simply, one, bad law, and two, certainly not what the legislature intended. Remember, the purpose of the DTPA, the DTPA must be construed liberally to protect the consumer. I mean, that's what it says, protect the consumer and provide efficient and economical procedures. And I submit that that construction, the construction that must follow from the respondent's position, is neither efficient nor economical, nor does it protect the consumer. Now,
so are you saying that the respondent's burden to prove that you weren't worth $25 million?
Yes, I say that first of all, the respondent must come in court and plead it. And that solves the problem of that you're going to meet in each one of these cases where you're going to have, if their formulation of the law stands, the plaintiff is going to have to prove, to introduce evidence of his wealth in every case. If they plead it, and it's their burden, then it's an issue. If they don't plead it and they don't introduce evidence, then the issue should not be in the case. It should be their burden. It should be treated akin to an affirmative defense. Now, I don't think we need to get into the whole morass of defenses under the DTPA. It's a complex question. I'm just saying that here, all that's necessary to do is for the court to say that it's the defendant's burden to exclude the plaintiff under that particular exception. Now, we've got a precedent, that a prior precedent that we need to distinguish. It's easy to distinguish. There's some very old law dealing with exceptions and provisos and how you read the statute and whether the exception or proviso is in the enacting clause or in another clause. Basically, our argument is that the legislature earlier, when it excluded service other than when it excluded commercial and business services from the definition of the act, and when the Supreme Court wrote Farmers and Merchants, State Bank of Crum against Ferguson, and said that the plaintiff had to negative that exception, that this case can be distinguished because the statute here reads differently. Here, the exception was moved to the end. It was introduced with a formula, except, which means an exception or proviso. That signals a switch in burden of proof. There's a lot of old law on the subject. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that the court is going to go back and look at that law, and that is what is going to decide the case. But I do believe that it is important that Farmers and Merchants be distinguished, because it's bad law. Farmers and Merchants must be distinguished, and moreover, it is irrelevant now. If you'll recall, when the legislature initially passed the DTPA, and it excluded services for commercial or business use, this court heard the Farmers and Merchants decision. There, what happened was that the plaintiff acquired services from the bank. He acquired some checking services. He paid a service charge. He was a consumer as to the bank's services. The bank dishonored his checks. He sued. The court allowed him to recover under a wrongful dishonor theory, and that is a very important case in the area of wrongful dishonor. But the court said no recovery for DTPA because he did not prove, because there was evidence that some of the checks were used for business purposes, and he didn't exclude it. Every one of the cases that followed after that dealt with mixed business and personal services. And so no one really realized how bad the result could be that flowed from that case. But in fact, and fortunately we didn't have to find out because the legislature changed the law in 1977, deleted that exception, and those cases died out. But if that had remained the law, this hypothetical would have been possible. A person comes to Austin, he's driving around, he has his car fixed. There's something wrong with the undercarriage. He's driving down one of these nice hill country roads, a bolt works loose, he goes over the edge, horrible injuries. He's a consumer as to the repairman services. Under Melody Homes, there is an implied warranty of good and workmanlike performance. And he puts on his case, and when it's over, and it's clearly services, when it's over, the defendant gets up and says, you know, Your Honor, there was no evidence that whether he was here on business or pleasure. Therefore, the plaintiff loses in that case under the law as it stood at the time of Farmers and Merchants. That's bad law. Fortunately, the legislature preserved the court from having to deal with that case, and it doesn't have to overrule it now. It just has to distinguish it. And it's easy to distinguish. We've given you the tools to do it. I believe that generally covers our statutory construction arguments. They're in three areas: the principle of liberal construction, the old law, the evil, and the remedy, and these rather arcane old rules about dealing with an exception or proviso. But I submit to you that this case really has a larger importance than merely the construction of this act and the placement of burden of proof in this particular instance. The Dallas Court of Appeals basically, in my opinion, is sending up a trial balloon. Basically, they have focused on the one part of the act that deals with the notion of business consumers. The only place in the act where business consumers is mentioned is this exclusion and the waiver exclusion. If you will read their opinion, it is clear that they are seeking to create a class of business consumers to recognize that there are certain people within the act called business consumers that are different from regular consumers. And in this case, it seems rather innocuous. But I submit to you that unless this court writes carefully, if this court countenances the segregation of business consumers within the DTPA, then you're going to be opening the door for a lot of trial judges and a lot of courts of appeals to think that there may be different rules for business consumers within the act.
Mr. Gilstrap, why did you plead that your client was a business consumer?
Because it was the truth. That was the reason.
If there's no difference between a consumer and a business consumer, why did you plead it?
Well, because the DTPA requires us, mandates efficient economic procedures. We just felt we should plead it. It got it out of the way. We clearly were a business consumer. So why not plead it and simply get that issue out of the way? Certainly, there should be no reason to penalize us for pleading it. I believe that to penalize us for pleading it, as the Dallas court did, would simply tell people not to go ahead and plead anything they don't have to plead because you may get trapped. The disposition of this case for the Dallas Court of Appeals has absolutely nothing to do with the merits of the underlying controversy.
You sort of got pushed on your own petard there. But
well, we're certainly trapped, and we were certainly tricked ourselves, and the court could do that, and there's a certain, you know, kind of irony and that could be brought into this case, and isn't that kind of funny that the plaintiff got tricked, he tricked himself. The point is it has nothing to do with the merits of the litigation. But we've got some good authority in here from no less than Charles Allen Wright, the United States Supreme Court, that says that pleading a particular item that is the other side's burden is not something that should switch the burden of proof. And I simply say that we shouldn't be penalized for it. Clearly, the Dallas court's opinion doesn't have anything to do with the rights of the underlying parties of the decision. What I believe it does do, though, is I believe it does segregate out business consumers. And if you countenance this, then soon, I believe you're going to have other cases before you in which there are attempts to restrict the rights of business consumers in other instances. Let me give you an example. They've got one ready and waiting. They say that since we gave financial statements that arguably show that we had assets of more than $25 million, that's really not true. The evidence is not that clear. But since we did give financial statements, we should now not be able to come into court and deny it. They're even saying that the jury shouldn't be able to not deny it. What that is a notion of conclusive evidence, estoppel. That's what's waiting in this case. That, I submit, is not the time. If this were a case involving normal consumers, the court would not countenance that argument. And I don't believe it will now. But if you say that business consumers should be treated differently, then I submit you're going to be confronted with a lot of arguments like that. And I submit if the court wants to re-decide Smith against Baldwin and Pennington against Single and Cameron against Terrell and Garrett, again, with a business consumer setting, there are plenty of people out there that will give it the opportunity to do so. So I say you must write very carefully there, because a lot of people are going to be reading your opinion just for that reason. I want to talk a little bit about an issue that I said I wouldn't get into because I was afraid I wouldn't have the time, and that's the issue of defenses under the Act. A lot of ink's been spilled over that. It's a complex issue. There is a body of thought out there that says that no defenses under the Act, no defenses under the Act, no defenses except in the defenses section, which is 17.506. I believe that the court is now, if the court ever thought about saying that, the court is backing off from that. There are clearly some defenses that are going to work in a DTPA setting. The court said in Alvarado against Bolton that we're going to talk about substantive defenses. Last week in Ojeda de Toca, the court said that there are some defenses under the Act, including 17.506, but imputed notice under the recordation statute is not one of them. There may be some defenses out there, but I think with regard to this particular case, it's very important to distinguish statutory defenses And by that, I mean defenses under the DTPA from non-statutory defenses, so-called common law defenses, statute of frauds, those type of things. This does not involve the second instance. This does not involve any type of notion of a common law defense. It involves, if anything, a statutory defense. And I think that it's pretty clear that over the years, the legislature has created things akin to defenses within the Act. We all know about 17.506, old 17.50B. And that was passed in 79. In 77 and 79, they created limitations. Well, that's a defense. Everybody knows the statute of limitations is a defense. In 1981, they added a waiver defense. You can waive if you have assets of now $5 million or more. And some of the pro-DTPA bar has had trouble with that. There's even a discussion in their appendix that says, oh no, that's not a defense. It must be a defense. I mean, surely, can the plaintiff, when this case is over, stand up and say, Your Honor, it's clear that plaintiffs had assets of more than $5 million, and they did not prove that they did not waive it? Clearly, that's got to be treated, that provision has got to be treated as a defense. And I think it's no problem to go in and treat the $25 million or more exclusion as a defense. Now, when I say defense, let's think about what a defense is. When I say defense, I'm not seeking to import a bunch of pre-DTPA law that's associated with the notion of defense into the DTPA. Not at all. What is a defense? A defense, at least for purposes of the DTPA, simply must be a pleading and burden of proof requirement. That's all it has to be. Remember, the DTPA is to be construed simply and efficiently. It's got to be construed in favor of the plaintiff, and the courts have made it clear from the beginning that we are not going to tolerate a lot of law being brought in from other areas. I don't think it's necessary to do so here. If you have problems with it being a defense, don't call it a defense. It's a placement of the burden of proof. I don't have any problems with calling it a statutory defense. And I think that the intent of the legislature is pretty clear. There is a historical progression that ultimately says that we've got to recognize these. Not to recognize them creates an intolerable situation. It creates bizarre results, and I submit to you it creates bad law. I believe that's all the remarks I have.
Mr. Gustav, assuming the court, for the sake of argument, would agree with your position, would this case have to go back to the CA? Because the CA won't rule on this point. And the court of appeals in the last line says it's not necessary that the appellant from any DTPA points of error be addressed. Now, assuming there was an insufficiency of evidence point, that would not rule on by the court.
Well, I'll be glad to speak to that, Your Honor. Thank you. And I didn't know whether the court wanted to get into that. It may not want to when it writes its opinion. The court has got two options. The court can do what it did in Ojeda de Talca and in Celio Dorado and I believe one other case. It can come in, deal with just this issue, and remand the rest of the case back to the Court of Appeals for disposition. That's what the court did in Ojeda de Talca. That's what it did in Celio Dorado, I believe. Or the court can go on and deal with the other issues over which it has jurisdiction. And we're talking no evidence points. This was a judgment NOV. The respondent brought forth cross points challenging every one of the jury findings on basis of no evidence and insufficient evidence. The court, I guess, could send the whole case back and allow the Court of Appeals to decide both the no evidence and the insufficient evidence points, or it could decide the no evidence points. I believe that it would be a simple matter for the court to decide the no evidence points. They are very simple. There are only really two I think we need to speak to, and I can talk to them very briefly here. One is the unconscionability point. The bank took a $54,000 commitment fee from us. It said it would give us a $2.7 million loan. It didn't give us the $2.7 million loan. We say that is evidence of gross disparity. They say, oh no, read the contract. We say this is DTPA. They say, look, we gave you a commitment. Here's the piece of paper. It's called a commitment. That's what you got for your money. We say the jury should be allowed to look at the whole transaction and decide, is there a gross disparity between the $54,000 that the plaintiff paid and what the plaintiff got?
Wasn't the total amount of some $2 million to be paid out on construction draws as progress payments?
No, it wasn't ever drawn. You see.
Isn't that what the contract called for?
That's what the money was paid for.
And the apartments never started.
What's that? The project was never started. That's right.
Well, how could they have an obligation to pay out that extra money then?
We say that they delayed the project so that it was no longer economically feasible for us to begin it. And that was argued for the jury, and that's what the jury decided. I believe that every one of these issues, while there's arguments on both sides, and the respondent can give you some nice arguments regarding the evidence, the point is there was evidence from which the jury could conclude there was a gross disparity. The jury could look at the entire transaction. The jury could look at the $54,000 we paid and what the ultimate result of the transaction we paid was, and decide, did we pay something for nothing? That is something that I say under DTPA, the jury should be allowed to decide and should not be decided under contractual principles, which is the way that the respondent wants to deal with it. The other issue is a failure to disclose issue. We say that when they took our $54,000, they had already decided not to make the loan to us. They say, oh no, there's evidence on the other side. There was evidence from which the jury could have concluded, because they were so eager to make us the loan, because there were financial problems with one of our other ventures that the bank knew about. But the bank went ahead, made us the loan, collected the $54,000 before the end of the accounting period, and then said, whoa, stop. We're going to require an audit, and it's going to go on for months. And we're going to require that you get documents, and the documents in our possession, we're not going to give them to you. That was evidence in the record. We say that is evidence of a failure to disclose, that they weren't going to fund the loan when, in fact, they made it. It was hard fought. The jury decided. This court can address those issues under no evidence standards. Obviously, if they ask, and I'm sure they will, if the court does it, the insufficient evidence points are going to have to go back. At least that's the way I read the law now. I believe that's all I have. If there are no further questions, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We will now hear argument from the respondent.
This is Kathleen LaValle, will present argument for Centennial Savings Bank.
May it please the court. My name is Kathleen LaValle, together with Michael Lowenberg from Aiken Gump Strauss Howard South and Larry Green from Newcomb, Green, Pemberton, and Weiss. I represent the respondent, Centennial Savings Bank. I'll be focusing on two points. First, that the Court of Appeals properly affirmed the judgment of the trial court because a DTPA claimant bears the burden of proof on every aspect of consumer status, including any qualifications to the applicable status. Secondly, the Court of Appeals properly affirmed the judgment of the trial court because regardless of the placement of the burden of proof, the evidence in this case, as the trial court found from the borrower's own financial statements, was conclusive that they exceeded the statutory limit to qualify them as business consumers.
Let me ask you this. In the event that a business consumer has assets in excess of $25 million, what rights under the DTPA are denied them?
Every right, Your Honor.
Every right.
Every right. This is a case of defining a private cause of action as to what consumers are entitled to maintain and to claim the benefits of a particular statutory provision.
All right. In that sense, then, wouldn't you say that in an effect is an avoidance of the statute, and that under Rule 94 the burden would be on you to affirmatively plead?
Not at all, Your Honor. I think we can distinguish this and can indicate that nothing about the statutory exclusion, which is built into the definition of an eligible consumer, either acts, looks, or operates like an affirmative defense. We're not talking about something which is an exemption from liability. We're not talking about something that at all avoids liability under the Act. There are still available a whole range of enforcement procedures other than that private cause of action. And the question becomes whether or not it is a matter of avoidance or whether or not it defines the eligibility of this particular consumer to bring a cause of action. And this court has always said that that definition, that eligibility standard, is something which is built into the plaintiff's cause of action. And with good reason in this case, the legislature has decided that the benefits of the DCPA are not going to apply across the board to every business consumer. And they've done that very definitely, and I'll go through the rules of statutory construction which get us there. Before starting with that, though, it's important to quiet any fears that may have been raised about the impact of this decision, of this law about consumer status, on cases other than our case and cases like it. First of all, there is no danger at all that the financial strength of every plaintiff in a DTPA cause of action is going to be placed at issue. This qualifying language having to do with the $25 million in assets only applies to, only modifies, and therefore only can disqualify those who are business consumers. So in the standard, the traditional consumer standing, or the traditional consumer setting, this issue of financial strength will in fact never be a factor. Once we realize that this applies only in business transactions, only in business deals, the question then becomes, how much of a burden is it in deciding who should be responsible for raising it and proving it? And the answer is, it's not difficult at all for the plaintiff to prove. In those cases in which it's clearly not in controversy, the defendant obviously would be wise to stipulate to it rather than to hear evidence of the plaintiff's destitute condition. If it's not stipulated to, plaintiff counsel's questioning goes something like this. Do you have assets in excess of $25 million? Answer, no. End of discussion. So the burden that the petitioners are complaining is being kept with them isn't much of a burden at all, and what they're bothered about having to prove isn't much of a bother. And if it's the only thing that makes you eligible for relief under a specific statutory scheme, then you can't complain about it having to be part of your case. What the petitioners in the case have raised through their briefing is offensive about this $25 million rule in the larger scheme really doesn't have anything to do with burden of proof. It has to do with the fact that the DTPA, in fact, has a $25 million standard. One of the evils the petitioners talked about is the discovery that will take place, the financial strength. Discovery, abusive or unabusive, will take place on this issue and continue to take place on this issue, regardless of the burden of proof. The issue isn't made relevant by who has to prove it. It's made relevant by the statute. And when you're looking at who to assign this burden to, one of the primary issues and one of the primary factors under Texas law is who is going to have the greater difficulty getting access to this necessary proof. And here the answer is clear. It makes much more sense to keep the burden on the party who already has access to the information, who can put on that information without having to do any discovery. This is the business consumer, the plaintiff. The plaintiff is in the best position to know, to have access to, and to prove its own financial strength.
Catherine, in this case, you had just as much information as they did because they had applied for a loan and they had, in fact, pumped up their financial statements to qualify for a loan.
They're suggesting on appeal that they had puffed up their financial statements, Your Honor, but in fact, the financial statements were not challenged in any effective means. They were conclusive, and as the trial court found, they were conclusive as to the amount of assets which these borrowers were claiming. So we did, in fact, have access to some of that information, but it came out, a good deal of it, in discovery, as has been discussed. This is not a case in which the issue of the $25 million limitation was any sort of surprise. Centennial had specially accepted to the pleadings of the plaintiff and said, tell us what your basis for consumer qualification is. The plaintiffs had come back and voluntarily amended and said, we're business consumers and we don't have in excess of $25 million. Centennial then proceeded at trial to put in the financial statements without objection, without limiting instruction, proving up that it wasn't just $25 million that the borrowers had boasted, but $28.5 million in assets. In response to the motion for instructed verdict, we didn't hear any expression of surprise. Trial counsel didn't stand up and say, we need a continuance to develop this unforeseen issue. Nothing like that. And in fact, there couldn't have been any expression of surprise. The matter had been raised both at the pleading stage, at the discovery stage, the indications from the discovery are cited in the brief, also at the evidence stage. Centennial didn't lie behind the log and just make this a no evidence kind of record. It put in the conclusive evidence itself. We also moved and objected to the jury instructions based on the fact that the evidence was conclusive that these particular borrowers did not prove their qualification as business consumers under the DTPA.
Was there a jury issue on
that? There was not a jury issue, Your Honor, and that's important.
Well, issue was drawn on the very fact, why was it missing?
Centennial took the position, as it continues to take, that under Texas law, consumer qualification is a matter of the proof for the plaintiff to show as an element of its cause of action. We stood up at the time of instructed verdict on two separate occasions and announced that position with no challenge to that characterization. Again, at the jury issue time, we said, it's undisputed. You can't get a jury issue on this because it's undisputed. And so we reaffirm again our motion for instructed verdict. But it's the plaintiff's burden of proof. And they, in that instance, did not come back and either request or obtain a jury finding on this issue, which is why, and I don't think it's really a matter debatable under Texas procedural law, that if the court upholds and this notion that consumer status is part of the plaintiff's cause of action, that the only proper result in this case, obviously, is to affirm the judgment. A party who goes forward without getting, requesting, or obtaining a jury issue on some essential element of their cause of action cannot be permitted to come to this court and ask for a new trial. They simply take nothing. One of the points that the petitioners have raised is that somehow or other we shouldn't require the law to remain the same about consumer qualification because most business consumers aren't going to have in excess of $25 million, talking about judicial efficiency. I don't know if that's an accurate observation or not, but it's immaterial. There are plenty of examples under Texas law where a particular element of the cause of action won't be controversial in the majority of the cases. And we do not, for that reason, switch the burden over to the defendant, recast something which was an element of the cause of action, recast it, and make it an affirmative defense. An example from federal law in the age discrimination cases. The statutory claimant has to prove that he or she was not less than 40 years old at the time of the discrimination. Will most claimants under the Age Discrimination Act be over 40 years old? Absolutely. Do we for that reason relieve the plaintiff of proving that point? Absolutely not. Texas has a Texas real estate dealer's license statute, which deals at least in part in the recovery of commissions for services performed under that and pursuant to that statute. The catch is, in order to maintain the cause of action, you have to show that you held a license, that you held a real estate license as a broker or an agent at the time you performed the services. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not a commission was due to you, whether or not there was an agreement, but it has a lot to do, as in this case, with who the legislature has said is entitled to the benefits of the act. Will the majority of claimants who specifically invoke the Real Estate Dealers License Act and who claim to be holding a license, will they in fact be license holders? Sure, they probably will be. Do we for that reason relieve them of that formal element, that part of the checklist of elements of proof which we're all familiar with in trying case? Do we relieve them of putting on that evidence to show that they fell within the protection of the statute? Absolutely not. In concluding the discussion of the broader implications of this rule, I want to point out what is perhaps the most dangerous, what is the most troublesome issue in the broader context, and that is the position which the petitioners urge would force this court to create a statutory presumption of consumer qualification in business transactions. That clearly is the opposite of what the legislature intended. The effect of mislabeling this aspect of consumer qualification as an affirmative defense is that businesses will qualify under the statutory standard supposedly with or without proof and will have to presume in the absence of that proof that they qualify. And what's wrong, what's unprecedented, and what's unwarranted about that move is that it completely contradicts this court's treatment and other courts' treatment of statutory benefits and what has to be shown to recover on them, under them. In the more traditional consumer setting, this court has never been willing to presume that the elements of the plaintiff's cause of action in a DTPA case have been satisfied. There's been no presumption in the absence of proof, for instance, that goods or services were being sought. There's been no presumption that the acts complained of fell within the effective date of the particular provision that you're relying upon. There's been no presumption in the pre-1977 version where we had that dichotomy between goods and service. There was no presumption that if services were involved, that they were for other than commercial use. Having been unwilling to supply this presumption in the traditional consumer setting, Centennial suggests the court should be particularly unwilling to supply it in this setting where the legislature has been ambivalent at best about whether or not the particular benefits of the DTPA should apply in business settings.
Let me ask a few questions, if you'll help me out with the background. Did the plaintiff come to this case with seeking alternative remedies other than the DTPA?
It's even stronger than that, Your Honor. They came only with a contract claim, which was eventually dismissed on the merits after weeks of testimony about the fact that the borrowers never met the conditions precedent to qualify under this loan, and after weeks of testimony that Centennial had not done anything in breach of this commitment agreement. And so, yes, they came with a contract cause of action to start with.
As it went to the jury, it was only DTPA.
Went to the jury with only DTPA.
And
the
both
contract
sides knew this issue was within the case. Neither side requested a jury issue. Both sides, the other side not requesting the jury?
No. The petitioners never objected to the fact that Centennial did not request an issue. They never challenged Centennial's characterization of this issue as a matter which was the plaintiff's burden of proof.
One never objects that the other side didn't ask for an issue.
Well, you do. You do in certain circumstances, Your Honor, but to avoid the deemed finding rules, but not in it couldn't be done in this case in any event. So it's but I do think it's significant that there wasn't any expression of surprise and that we were doing all the objecting and the petitioners were not having any problem with the fact that no issue was being submitted on our side of it. In addition, as I'll get into in the second point I'd like to discuss, is the fact that in the post-verdict settings, when the judgments, motions for judgment were being filed by Centennial,